He seemed to think we were a visionary group open to special forms of consciousness. There were huge amounts of data flowing through the house, waiting to be analyzed. He went upstairs with the three kids to watch TV. Heinrich walked into the kitchen, sat at the table, and gripped a fork tightly in each hand. The refrigerator throbbed massively. I flipped a switch, and somewhere beneath the sink a grinding mechanism reduced parings, rinds, and animal fats to tiny drainable fragments, with a motorized surge that made me retreat 2 paces. I took the forks out of my son's hands and put them in the dishwasher. "Do you drink coffee yet?" "No," he said. "Baba likes a cup when she gets back from class."
"Make her tea instead."
"She doesn't like tea."
"She can learn, can't she?"
"The two things have completely different tastes."
"A habit's a habit."
"You have to acquire it first."
"That's what I'm saying. Make her tea."
"Her class is more demanding than it sounds. Coffee relaxes her."
"That's why it's dangerous," he said.
"It's not dangerous."
"Whatever relaxes you is dangerous. If you don't know that, I might as well be talking to the wall."
"Murray would also like coffee," I said, aware of a small note of triumph in my voice.
"Did you see what you just did? You took the coffee can with you to the counter."
"So what?"
"You didn't have to. You could have left it by the stove where you were standing and then gone to the counter to get the spoon."
"You're saying I carried the coffee can unnecessarily?"
"You carried it in your right hand all the way to the counter, put it down to open the drawer, which you didn't want to do with your left hand, then got the spoon with your right hand, switched it to your left hand, picked up the coffee can with your right hand, and went back to the stove, where you put it down again."
"That's what people do."
"It's wasted motion. People waste tremendous amounts of motion. You ought to watch Baba make a salad sometime."
"People don't deliberate over each tiny motion and gesture." "A little waste doesn't hurt."
"But over a lifetime?"
"What do you save if you don't waste?"
"Over a lifetime? You save tremendous amounts of time and energy," he said.
"What will you do with them?"
"Use them to live longer."
"The truth is, I don't want to die first. Given a choice between loneliness and death, it would take me a fraction of a second to decide. But I don't want to be alone either. Everything I say to Babette about holes and gaps is true. Her death would leave me scattered, talking to chairs and pillows. Don't let us die, I want to cry out to that 5th-century sky ablaze with mystery and spiral light. Let us both live forever in sickness and health. Feeble-minded, doddering, toothless, liver-spotted, dim-sighted, hallucinating. Who decides these things? What is out there? Who are you?" I watched the coffee bubble up through the center tube and perforated basket into the small pale globe. A marvelous and sad invention, so roundabout, ingenious, human. It was like a philosophical argument rendered in terms of the things of the world, water, metal, brown beans. I had never looked at coffee before. "When plastic furniture burns, you get cyanide poisoning," Heinrich said, tapping the Formica tabletop. He ate a winter peach. I poured a cup of coffee for Murray, and together the boy and I went up the stairs to Denise's room, where the TV set was currently located. The volume was kept way down, the girls engaged in a rapt dialogue with their guest. Murray looked happy to be there. He sat in the middle of the floor taking notes, his toggle coat and touring cap next to him on the rug. The room around him was rich in codes and messages. An archaeology of childhood, things Denise had carried with her since the age of 3, from cartoon clocks to werewolf posters.
She is the kind of child who feels a protective tenderness toward her own beginnings. It is part of her strategy in a world of displacements to make every effort to restore and preserve, keep things together for their value as remembering objects, a way of fastening herself to a life. Make no mistake, I take these children seriously. It is not possible to see too much in them, to overindulge your casual gift for the study of character. It is all there, in full force, charged waves of identity and being. There are no amateurs in the world of children. Heinrich stood in a corner of the room, taking up his critical observer position. I gave Murray his coffee and was about to leave when I glanced in passing at the TV screen. I paused at the door, looked more closely this time. It was true. It was there. I hissed at the others for silence, and they swiveled their heads in my direction, baffled and annoyed. Then they followed my gaze to the sturdy TV at the end of the bed. The face on the screen was Babette's. Out of our mouths came a silence as wary and deep as an animal growl. Confusion, fear, astonishment spilled from our faces. What did it mean? What was she doing there in black and white, framed in formal borders? Was she dead? Missing? Disembodied? Was this her spirit, her secret self, some two-dimensional facsimile released by the power of technology, set free to glide through wave bands, through energy levels, pausing to say goodbye to us from the fluorescent screen? A strangeness gripped me, a sense of psychic disorientation. It was her, all right, the face, the hair, the way she blinks in rapid twos and threes. I'd seen her just an hour ago, eating eggs. But her appearance on the screen made me think of her as some distant figure from the past, some ex-wife and absentee mother, a walker in the mists of the dead. If she was not dead, was I? A two-syllable infantile cry, "Baba," issued from the deeps of my soul. All this compressed in seconds. It was only as time drew on, normalized itself, returned to us a sense of our surroundings, the room, the house, the reality in which the TV set stood. It was only then that we understood what was going on. Babette was teaching her class in the church basement, and it was being televised by the local cable station. Either she hadn't known there would be a camera on hand, or she preferred not to tell us, out of embarrassment, love, superstition, whatever causes a person to wish to withhold her image from those who know her. With the sounds down low, we couldn't hear what she was saying. But no one bothered to adjust the volume. It was the picture that mattered, the face in black and white, animated but also flat, distanced, sealed off, timeless. It was, but wasn't, her. Once again I began to think Murray might be onto something, waves and radiation. Something leaked through the mesh. She was shining a light on us. She was coming into being, endlessly being formed and reformed as the muscles in her face worked at smiling and speaking, as the electronic dots swarmed. We were being shot through with Babette. Her image was projected on our bodies, swam in us and through us. Babette of electrons and photons, of whatever forces produced that gray light we took to be her face. The kids were flushed with excitement, but I felt a certain disquiet. I tried to tell myself it was only television, whatever that was, however it worked, and not some journey out of life or death, not some mysterious separation. Murray looked up at me, smiling in his sneaky way. Only Wilder remained calm. He watched his mother, spoke to her in half-words, sensible-sounding fragments that were mainly fabricated. As the camera pulled back to allow Babette to demonstrate some fine points of standing or walking, Wilder approached the set and touched her body, leaving a handprint on the dusty surface of the screen. Then Denise crawled up to the set and turned the volume dial. Nothing happened. There was no sound, no voice, nothing. She turned to look at me, a moment of renewed confusion. Heinrich advanced, fiddled with the dial, stuck his hand behind the set to adjust the recessed knobs. When he tried another channel, the sound boomed out, raw and fuzzy. Back at the cable station, he couldn't raise a buzz, and as we watched Babette finish the lesson, we were in a mood of odd misgiving. But as soon as the program ended, the two girls got excited again and went downstairs to wait for Babette at the door and surprise her with news of what they'd seen. The small boy remained at the TV set, within inches of the dark screen, crying softly, uncertainly, in low heaves and swells, as Murray took notes. Part 2. The Airborne Toxic Event. Chapter 21. After a night of dreamlit snows, the air turned clear and still. There was a taut blue quality in the January light, a hardness and confidence. The sound of boots on packed snow, the contrails streaked cleanly in the high sky. Weather was very much the point, although I didn't know it at first. I turned into our street and walked past men bent over shovels in their driveways, breathing vapor. A squirrel moved along a limb in a flowing motion, a passage so continuous it seemed to be its own physical law, different from the ones we've learned to trust. When I was halfway down the street, I saw Heinrich crouched on a small ledge outside our attic window. He wore his camouflage jacket and cap, an outfit with complex meaning for him, at 14. Struggling to grow and to escape notice simultaneously, his secrets known to us all. He looked east through binoculars. I went around back to the kitchen. In the entranceway, the washer and dryer were vibrating nicely. I could tell from Babette's voice that the person she was talking to on the phone was her father. An impatience mixed with guilt and apprehension. I stood behind her, put my cold hands to her cheeks. A little thing I liked to do. She hung up the phone. "Why is he on the roof?"
"Heinrich? Something about the train yards," she said. "It was on the radio."
"Shouldn't I get him down?"
"Why?"
"He could fall."
"Don't tell him that."
"Why not?"
"He thinks you underestimate him."
"He's on a ledge," I said. "There must be something I should be doing."
"The more you show concern, the closer he'll go to the edge."
"I know that, but I still have to get him down."
"Coax him back in," she said. "Be sensitive and caring. Get him to talk about himself. Don't make sudden movements."
When I got to the attic, he was already back inside, standing by the open window, still looking through the glasses. Abandoned possessions were everywhere, oppressive and soul-worrying, creating a weather of their own among the exposed beams and posts, the fiberglass insulation pads.
"What happened?"
"The radio said a tank car derailed. But I don't think it derailed from what I could see. I think it got rammed and something punched a hole in it. There's a lot of smoke and I don't like the looks of it."
"What does it look like?"
He handed me the binoculars and stepped aside. Without climbing onto the ledge, I couldn't see the switching yard and the car or cars in question. But the smoke was plainly visible, a heavy black mass hanging in the air beyond the river, more or less shapeless.
"Did you see fire engines?"
"They're all over the place," he said. "But it looks to me like they're not getting too close. It must be pretty toxic or pretty explosive stuff, or both."
"It won't come this way." How do you know?
It just won't. The point is you shouldn't be standing on icy ledges. It worries Baba.
You think if you tell me it worries her, I'll feel guilty and not do it. But if you tell me it worries you, I'll do it all the time.
Shut the window, I told him.
We went down to the kitchen. Steffi was looking through the brightly colored mail for coupons, lotteries, and contests. This was the last day of the holiday break for the grade school and high school. Classes on the hill would resume in a week. I sent Heinrich outside to clear snow from the walk. I watched him stand out there, utterly still, his head turned slightly, a honed awareness in his stance. It took me a while to realize he was listening to the sirens beyond the river. An hour later, he was back in the attic, this time with a radio and highway map. I climbed the narrow stairs, borrowed the glasses, and looked again. It was still there, a slightly larger accumulation. A towering mass, in fact. Maybe a little blacker now.
The radio calls it a feathery plume, he said. But it's not a plume.
What is it?
Like a shapeless growing thing. A dark, black, breathing thing of smoke.
Why do they call it a plume?
Airtime is valuable. They can't go into long, tortured descriptions.
Have they said what kind of chemical it is?
It's called niodine derivative, or niodine D. It was in a movie we saw in school on toxic wastes. These videotaped rats.
What does it cause?
The movie wasn't sure what it does to humans. Mainly it was rats growing urgent lumps.
That's what the movie said. What does the radio say?
At first they said skin irritation and sweaty palms. But now they say nausea, vomiting, shortness of breath.
This is human nausea we're talking about. Not rats.
Not rats, he said. I gave him the binoculars.
Well, it won't come this way.
How do you know? He said.
I just know. It's perfectly calm and still today. And when there's a wind at this time of year, it blows that way, not this way.
What if it blows this way?
It won't.
Just this one time.
It won't. Why should it?
He paused a beat and said in a flat tone,
They just closed part of the interstate.
Well, they would want to do that, of course.
Why?
They just would. A sensible precaution. A way to facilitate movement of service vehicles and such. Any number of reasons that have nothing to do with wind or wind direction. Babette's head appeared at the top of the stairway. She said a neighbor had told her the spill from the tank car was 35,000 gallons. People were being told to stay out of the area. A feathery plume hung over the site. She also said the girls were complaining of sweaty palms.
There's been a correction, Heinrich told her. Tell them they ought to be throwing up.
A helicopter flew over, headed in the direction of the accident. The voice on the radio said,
Available for a limited time only with optional megabyte hard disk.
Babette's head sank out of sight.
I watched Heinrich tape the road map to two posts. Then I went down to the kitchen to pay some bills, aware of colored spots whirling atomically somewhere to the right and behind me.
Steffi said, Can you see the feathery plume from the attic window?
It's not a plume.
But will we have to leave our homes?
Of course not.
How do you know?
I just know.
Remember how we couldn't go to school?
That was inside. This is outside.
We heard police sirens blowing. I watched Steffi's lips form the sequence. Wow, 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 wow.
She smiled in a certain way when she saw me watching, as though gently startled out of some absent-minded pleasure.
Denise walked in, rubbing her hands on her jeans. "They're using snowblowers to blow stuff onto the spill," she said.
"What kind of stuff?"
"I don't know, but it's supposed to make the spill harmless, which doesn't explain what they're doing about the actual plume."
"They're keeping it from getting bigger," I said.
"When do we eat?"
"I don't know, but if it gets any bigger, it'll get here with or without a wind."
"It won't get here," I said.
"How do you know?"
"Because it won't."
She looked at her palms and went upstairs. The phone rang. Babette walked into the kitchen and picked it up. She looked at me as I listened. I wrote 2 checks, periodically glancing up to see if she was still looking at me. She seemed to study my face for the hidden meaning of the message she was receiving. I puckered my lips in a way I knew she disliked.
"That was the Stovers," she said. "They spoke directly with the weather center outside Glassboro. They're not calling it a feathery plume anymore."
"What are they calling it?"
"A black billowing cloud."
"That's a little more accurate, which means they're coming to grips with the thing. Good."
"There's more," she said. "It's expected that some sort of air mass may be moving down from Canada."
"There's always an air mass moving down from Canada."
"That's true," she said. "There's certainly nothing new in that. And since Canada is to the north, if the billowing cloud is blown due south, it will miss us by a comfortable margin."
"When do we eat?" I said.
We heard sirens again, a difference at this time. A larger sound. Not police, fire, ambulance. They were air raid sirens, I realized, and they seemed to be blowing in Sawyersville, a small community to the northeast. Steffi washed her hands at the kitchen sink and went upstairs. Babette started taking things out of the refrigerator. I grabbed her by the inside of the thigh as she passed the table. She squirmed deliciously, a package of frozen corn in her hand.
"Maybe we ought to be more concerned about the billowing cloud," she said. "It's because of the kids we keep saying nothing's going to happen. We don't want to scare them."
"Nothing is going to happen."
"I know nothing's going to happen. You know nothing's going to happen. But at some level we ought to think about it anyway, just in case."
"These things happen to poor people who live in exposed areas. Society is set up in such a way that it's the poor and the uneducated who suffer the main impact of natural and man-made disasters. People in low-lying areas get the floods. People in shanties get the hurricanes and tornadoes."
"I'm a college professor. Did you ever see a college professor rowing a boat down his own street in one of those TV floods? We live in a neat and pleasant town near a college with a quaint name. These things don't happen in places like Blacksmith."
She was sitting on my lap by now. The checks, bills, contest forms, and coupons were scattered across the table.
"Why do you want dinner so early?" she said in a sexy whisper.
"I missed lunch."
"Shall I do some chili fried chicken?"
"First rate."
"Where is Wilder?" she said, thick-voiced, as I ran my hands over her breasts, trying with my teeth to undo her bra clip through the blouse.
"I don't know. Maybe Murray stole him."
"I ironed your gown," she said.
"Great. Great.
Did you pay the phone bill?"
"Can't find it."
We were both thick-voiced now. Her arms were crossed over my arms in such a way that I could read the serving suggestions on the box of corn niblets in her left hand.
"Let's think about the billowing cloud. Just a little bit, okay? It could be dangerous."
"Everything in tank cars is dangerous. But the effects are mainly long-range, and all we have to do is stay out of the way."
"Let's just be sure to keep it in the back of our mind," she said, getting up to smash an ice tray repeatedly on the rim of the sink, dislodging the cubes in groups of 2 and 3.
I puckered my lips at her. Then I climbed to the attic one more time.
Wilder was up there with Heinrich, whose fast glance in my direction contained a certain practiced accusation.
"They're not calling it the Feathery Plume anymore," he said, not meeting my eyes, as if to spare himself the pain of my embarrassment. I already knew that. "They're calling it the Black Billowing Cloud."
"Good."
"Why is that good?"
"It means they're looking the thing more or less squarely in the eye. They're on top of the situation." With an air of weary decisiveness, I opened the window, took the binoculars, and climbed onto the ledge. I was wearing a heavy sweater and felt comfortable enough in the cold air, but made certain to keep my weight tipped against the building, with my son's outstretched hand clutching my belt. I sensed his support for my little mission, even his hopeful conviction that I might be able to add the balanced weight of a mature and considered judgment to his pure observations. This is a parent's task, after all. I put the glasses to my face and peered through the gathering dark. Beneath the cloud of vaporized chemicals, the scene was one of urgency and operatic chaos. Floodlights swept across the switching yard. Army helicopters hovered at various points, shining additional lights down on the scene. Colored lights from police cruisers crisscrossed these wider beams. The tank car sat solidly on tracks, fumes rising from what appeared to be a hole in one end. The coupling device from a second car had apparently pierced the tank car. Fire engines were deployed at a distance, ambulances and police vans at a greater distance. I could hear sirens, voices calling through bullhorns, a layer of radio static causing small warps in the frosty air. Men raced from one vehicle to another, unpacked equipment, carried empty stretchers. Other men in bright yellow Mylex suits and respirator masks moved slowly through the luminous haze, carrying death-measuring instruments. Snowblowers sprayed a pink substance toward the tank car and the surrounding landscape. This thick mist arched through the air like some grand confection at a concert of patriotic music. The snowblowers were the type used on airport runways. The police vans were the type to transport riot casualties. Smoke drifted from red beams of light into darkness, and then into the breadth of scenic white floods. The men in Mylex suits moved with a lunar caution. Each step was the exercise of some anxiety not provided for by instinct. Fire and explosion were not the inherent dangers here. This death would penetrate, seep into the genes, show itself in bodies not yet born. They moved as if across a swale of moon dust, bulky and wobbling, trapped in the idea of the nature of time. I crawled back inside with some difficulty. "What do you think?" he said. "It's still hanging there. Looks rooted to the spot."
"So you're saying you don't think it'll come this way?"
"I can tell by your voice that you know something I don't know. Do you think it'll come this way or not?"
"You want me to say it won't come this way in a million years. Then you'll attack with your little fistful of data. Come on, tell me what they said on the radio while I was out there."
"It doesn't cause nausea, vomiting, shortness of breath, like they said before."
"What does it cause?"
"Heart palpitations and a sense of déjà vu."
"Déjà vu?"
"It affects the false part of the human memory or whatever."
"That's not all. They're not calling it the Black Billowing Cloud anymore."
"What are they calling it?"
He looked at me carefully.
"The Airborne Toxic Event." He spoke these words in a clipped and foreboding manner, syllable by syllable, as if he sensed the threat in state-created terminology. He continued to watch me carefully, searching my face for some reassurance against the possibility of real danger,
a reassurance he would immediately reject as phony. A favorite ploy of his. These things are not important. The important thing is location. It's there. We're here. A large air mass is moving down from Canada, he said evenly. I already knew that. That doesn't mean it's not important. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Depends. The weather's about to change, he practically cried out to me in a voice charged with the plaintive throb of his special time of life. I'm not just a college professor. I'm the head of a department. I don't see myself fleeing an airborne toxic event. That's for people who live in mobile homes out in the scrubby parts of the county, where the fish hatcheries are. We watched Wilder climb backwards down the attic steps, which were higher than the steps elsewhere in the house. At dinner, Denise kept getting up and walking in small, stiff, rapid strides to the toilet off the hall. A hand clapped to her mouth. We paused in odd moments of chewing or salt sprinkling to hear her retch incompletely. Heinrich told her she was showing outdated symptoms. She gave him a slit-eyed look. It was a period of looks and glances, teeming interactions, part of the sensory array I ordinarily cherish. Heat, noise, lights, looks, words, gestures, personalities, appliances. A colloquial density that makes family life the one medium of sense knowledge in which an astonishment of heart is routinely contained. I watched the girls communicate in hooded looks. "Aren't we eating a little early tonight?" Denise said. "What do you call early?" her mother said. Denise looked at Steffi. "Is it because we want to get it out of the way?" she said. "Why do we want to get it out of the way?" "In case something happens," Steffi said. "What could happen?" Babette said. The girls looked at each other again, a solemn and lingering exchange that indicated some dark suspicion was being confirmed. Air raid sirens sounded again, this time so close to us that we were negatively affected, shaken to the point of avoiding each other's eyes as a way of denying that something unusual was going on. The sound came from our own red brick firehouse, sirens that hadn't been tested in a decade or more. They made a noise like some territorial squawk from out of the Mesozoic. A parrot carnivore with a DC-9 wingspan. What a raucousness of brute aggression filled the house, making it seem as though the walls would fly apart. So close to us, so surely upon us. Amazing to think this sonic monster lay hidden nearby for years. We went on eating, quietly and neatly, reducing the size of our bites, asking politely for things to be passed. We became meticulous and terse, diminished the scope of our movements, buttered our bread in the manner of technicians restoring a fresco. Still, the horrific squawk went on. We continued to avoid eye contact, were careful not to clink utensils. I believe there passed among us the sheepish hope that only in this way could we avoid being noticed. It was as though the sirens heralded the presence of some controlling mechanism, a thing we would do well not to provoke with our contentiousness and spilled food. It wasn't until a second noise became audible in the pulse of the powerful sirens that we thought to effect a pause in our little episode of decorous hysteria. Heinrich ran to the front door and opened it. The night's combined sounds came washing in with a freshness and renewed immediacy. For the first time in minutes we looked at each other, knowing the new sound was an amplified voice, but not sure what it was saying. Heinrich returned, walking in an over-deliberate and stylized manner with elements of stealth. This seemed to mean he was frozen with significance.
"They want us to evacuate," he said, not meeting our eyes.
Babette said, "Did you get the impression they were only making a suggestion, or was it a little more mandatory, do you think?"
"It was a fire captain's car with a loudspeaker, and it was going pretty fast."
I said, "In other words, you didn't have an opportunity to notice the subtle edges of intonation."
The voice was screaming out.
"Due to the sirens," Babette said helpfully.
"It said something like, 'Evacuate all places of residence. Cloud of deadly chemicals. Cloud of deadly chemicals.'"
We sat there over sponge cake and canned peaches.
"I'm sure there's plenty of time," Babette said, "or they would have made a point of telling us to hurry. How fast do air masses move, I wonder?"
Steffi read a coupon for Baby Lux, crying softly. This brought Denise to life. She went upstairs to pack some things for all of us. Heinrich raced two steps at a time to the attic for his binoculars, highway map, and radio. Babette went to the pantry and began gathering tins and jars with familiar life-enhancing labels. Steffi helped me clear the table. 20 minutes later, we were in the car. The voice on the radio said that people in the west end of town were to head for the abandoned Boy Scout camp, where Red Cross volunteers would dispense juice and coffee. People from the east end were to take the parkway to the fourth service area, where they would proceed to a restaurant called the Kung Fu Palace, a multi-wing building with pagodas, lily ponds, and live deer. We were among the latecomers in the former group and joined the traffic flow into the main route out of town, a sordid gauntlet of used cars, fast food, discount drugs, and quad cinemas. As we waited our turn to edge onto the four-lane road, we heard the amplified voice above and behind us calling out to darkened homes in a street of sycamores and tall hedges. "Abandon all domiciles! Now! Now! Toxic event! Chemical cloud!" The voice grew louder, faded, grew loud again as the vehicle moved in and out of local streets. "Toxic event! Chemical cloud!" When the words became faint, the cadence itself was still discernible, a recurring sequence in the distance. It seems that danger assigns to public voices the responsibility of a rhythm, as if in metrical units there is a coherence we can use to balance whatever senseless and furious event is about to come rushing around our heads. We made it onto the road as snow began to fall. We had little to say to each other, our minds not yet adjusted to the actuality of things, the absurd fact of evacuation. Mainly, we looked at people in other cars, trying to work out from their faces how frightened we should be. Traffic moved at a crawl, but we thought the pace would pick up some miles down the road, where there is a break in the barrier divide that would enable our westbound flow to utilize all four lanes. The two opposite lanes were empty, which meant police had already halted traffic coming this way. An encouraging sign. What people in an exodus fear most immediately is that those in positions of authority will long since have fled, leaving us in charge of our own chaos. The snow came more thickly. The traffic moved in fits and starts. There was a lifestyle sale at a home furnishing mart. Well-lighted men and women stood by the huge window looking out at us and wondering. It made us feel like fools, like tourists doing all the wrong things. Why were they content to shop for furniture while we sat, panicky in slow-poke traffic, in a snowstorm? They knew something we didn't. In a crisis, the true facts are whatever other people say they are. No one's knowledge is less secure than your own. Air raid sirens were still sounding in two or more towns.
What could those shoppers know that would make them remain behind while a more or less clear path to safety lay before us all? I started pushing buttons on the radio. On a Glassboro station, we learned there was new and important information. People already indoors were being asked to stay indoors. We were left to guess the meaning of this. Were the roads impossibly jammed? Was it snowing Niodine D? I kept punching buttons, hoping to find someone with background information. A woman identified as a consumer affairs editor began a discussion of the medical problems that could result from personal contact with the airborne toxic event. Babette and I exchanged a wary glance. She immediately began talking to the girls while I turned the volume down to keep them from learning what they might imagine was in store for them. "Convulsions, coma, miscarriage," said the well-informed and sprightly voice. We passed a three-story motel. Every room was lighted, every window filled with people staring out at us. We were a parade of fools, open not only to the effects of chemical fallout, but to the scornful judgment of other people. Why weren't they out here, sitting in heavy coats behind windshield wipers in the silent snow? It seemed imperative that we get to the Boy Scout camp, scramble into the main building, seal the doors, huddle on camp beds with our juice and coffee, wait for the all-clear. Cars began to mount the grassy incline at the edge of the road, creating a third lane of severely tilted traffic. Situated in what had formerly been the right-hand lane, we didn't have any choice but to watch these cars pass us at a slightly higher elevation and with a rakish thrust, deviated from the horizontal. Slowly we approached an overpass, seeing people on foot up there. They carried boxes and suitcases, objects in blankets, a long line of people leaning into the blowing snow. People cradling pets and small children. An old man wearing a blanket over his pajamas. Two women shouldering a rolled-up rug. There were people on bicycles, children being pulled on sleds and in wagons. People in supermarket carts. People clad in every kind of bulky outfit, peering out from deep hoods. There was a family wrapped completely in plastic, a single large sheet of transparent polyethylene. They walked beneath their shield in lockstep, the man and woman each at one end, three kids between, all of them secondarily wrapped in shimmering rainwear. The whole affair had about it a well-rehearsed and self-satisfied look, as though they'd been waiting for months to strut their stuff. People kept appearing from behind a high rampart and trudging across the overpass, shoulders dusted with snow, hundreds of people moving with a kind of fated determination. A new round of sirens started up. The trudging people did not quicken their pace, did not look down at us or into the night sky for some sign of the wind-driven cloud. They just kept moving across the bridge through patches of snow-raging light. Out in the open, keeping their children near, carrying what they could, they seemed to be part of some ancient destiny, connected in doom and ruin to a whole history of people trekking across wasted landscapes. There was an epic quality about them that made me wonder for the first time at the scope of our predicament. The radio said, "It's the rainbow hologram that gives this credit card a marketing intrigue." We moved slowly beneath the overpass, hearing a flurry of automobile horns and the imploring wail of an ambulance stuck in traffic. 50 yards ahead, the traffic narrowed to one lane, and we soon saw why. One of the cars had skidded off the incline and barreled into a vehicle in our lane. Horns quacked up and down the line. A helicopter sat just above us, shining a white beam down on the mass of collapsed metal. People sat dazed on the grass, being tended to by a pair of bearded paramedics. Two people were bloody,
There was blood on a smashed window. Blood soaked upward through newly fallen snow. Drops of blood speckled a tan handbag. The scene of injured people, medics, smoking steel, all washed in a strong and eerie light, took on the eloquence of a formal composition. We passed silently by, feeling curiously reverent, even uplifted by the sight of the heaped cars and fallen people. Heinrich kept watching through the rear window, taking up his binoculars as the scene dwindled in the distance. He described for us in detail the number and placement of bodies, the skid marks, the vehicular damage. When the wreck was no longer visible, he talked about everything that had happened since the air raid siren at dinner. He spoke enthusiastically, with a sense of appreciation for the vivid and unexpected. I thought we'd all occupied the same mental state, subdued, worried, confused. It hadn't occurred to me that one of us might find these events brilliantly stimulating. I looked at him in the rearview mirror. He sat slouched in the camouflage jacket with Velcro closures, steeped happily in disaster. He talked about the snow, the traffic, the trudging people. He speculated on how far we were from the abandoned camp, what sort of primitive accommodations might be available there. I'd never heard him go on about something with such spirited enjoyment. He was practically giddy. He must have known we could all die. Was this some kind of end-of-the-world elation? Did he seek distraction from his own small miseries in some violent and overwhelming event? His voice betrayed a craving for terrible things. "Is this a mild winter or a harsh winter?" Steffi said. "Compared to what?" Denise said. "I don't know." I thought I saw Babette slip something into her mouth. I took my eye off the road for a moment, watched her carefully. She looked straight ahead. I pretended to return my attention to the road, but quickly turned once more, catching her off guard as she seemed to swallow whatever it was she'd put in her mouth. "What's that?" I said. "Drive the car, Jack. I saw your throat contract. You swallowed something." "Just a lifesaver. Drive the car, please." "You place a lifesaver in your mouth and you swallow it without an interval of sucking?" "Swallow what? It's still in my mouth." She thrust her face toward me, using her tongue to make a small lump in her cheek. A clear-cut, amateurish bluff. "But you swallowed something. I saw." "That was just saliva that I didn't know what to do with. Drive the car, would you?" I sensed that Denise was getting interested and decided not to pursue the matter. This was not the time to be questioning her mother about medications, side effects, and so on. Wilder was asleep, leaning into Babette's arm. The windshield wipers made sweaty arcs. From the radio, we learned that dogs trained to sniff out Niadine D were being sent to the area from a chemical detection center in a remote part of New Mexico. Denise said, "Did they ever think about what happens to the dogs when they get close enough to this stuff to smell it?" "Nothing happens to the dogs," Babette said.
"How do you know?"
"Because it only affects humans and rats."
"I don't believe you."
"Ask Jack."
"Ask Heinrich," I said.
"It could be true," he said, clearly lying. "They use rats to test for things that humans can catch, so it means we get the same diseases, rats and humans. Besides, they wouldn't use dogs if they thought it could hurt them."
"Why not?"
"A dog is a mammal."
"So's a rat," Denise said.
"A rat is a vermin," Babette said. "Mostly what a rat is," Heinrich said, "is a rodent."
"It's also a vermin."
"A cockroach is a vermin," Steffi said.
A cockroach is an insect. You count the legs is how you know. It's also a vermin.
Does a cockroach get cancer?
No, Denise said.
That must mean a rat is more like a human than it is like a cockroach, even if they're both vermins, since a rat and a human can get cancer, but a cockroach can't.
In other words, Heinrich said, she's saying that two things that are mammals have more in common than two things that are only vermins.
Are you people telling me, Babette said, that a rat is not only a vermin and a rodent, but a mammal too?
Snow turned to sleet, sleet to rain. We reached the point where the concrete barrier gives way to a 20-yard stretch of landscaped median, no higher than a curbstone. But instead of a state trooper directing traffic into two extra lanes, we saw a Milex-suited man waving us away from the opening. Just beyond him was the scrap metal burial mound of a Winnebago and a snowplow. The huge and tortured wreck emitted a wisp of rusty smoke. Brightly colored plastic utensils were scattered for some distance. There was no sign of victims or fresh blood, leading us to believe that some time had passed since the recreational vehicle mounted the plow, probably in a moment when opportunism seemed an easily defensible failing, given the situation. It must have been the blinding snow that caused the driver to leap the median without noting an object on the other side.
"I saw all this before," Steffi said.
"What do you mean?" I said.
"This happened once before. Just like this. The man in the yellow suit and gas mask. The big wreck sitting in the snow. It was totally and exactly like this. We were all here in the car. Rain made little holes in the snow, everything."
It was Heinrich who'd told me that exposure to the chemical waste could cause a person to experience a sense of déjà vu. Steffi wasn't there when he said it, but she could have heard it on the kitchen radio, where she and Denise had probably learned about sweaty palms and vomiting before developing these symptoms themselves. I didn't think Steffi knew what déjà vu meant, but it was possible Babette had told her. Déjà vu, however, was no longer a working symptom of niodine contamination. It had been preempted by coma, convulsions, and miscarriage. If Steffi had learned about déjà vu on the radio but then missed the subsequent upgrading to more deadly conditions, it could mean she was in a position to be tricked by her own apparatus of suggestibility. She and Denise had been lagging all evening. They were late with sweaty palms, late with nausea, late again with déjà vu. What did it all mean? Did Steffi truly imagine she'd seen the wreck before? Or did she only imagine she'd imagined it? Is it possible to have a false perception of an illusion? Is there a true déjà vu and a false déjà vu? I wondered whether her palms had been truly sweaty, or whether she'd simply imagined a sense of wetness. And was she so open to suggestion that she would develop every symptom as it was announced? I feel sad for people, and the queer part we play in our own disasters. But what if she hadn't heard the radio, didn't know what déjà vu was? What if she was developing real symptoms by natural means? Maybe the scientists were right in the first place, with their original announcements, before they revised upward. Which was worse, the real condition or the self-created one? And did it matter? I wondered about these and allied questions. As I drove, I found myself giving and taking an oral examination based on the kind of quibbling fine points that had entertained several centuries' worth of medieval idlers. Could a 9-year-old girl suffer a miscarriage due to the power of suggestion? Would she have to be pregnant first? Could the power of suggestion be strong enough to work backward in this manner, from miscarriage to pregnancy to menstruation to ovulation? Which comes first, menstruation or ovulation? Are we talking about mere symptoms or deeply entrenched conditions? Is a symptom a sign or a thing? What is a thing
And how do we know it's not another thing?
I turned off the radio, not to help me think, but to keep me from thinking. Vehicles lurched and skidded. Someone threw a gum wrapper out a side window, and Babette made an indignant speech about inconsiderate people littering the highways and countryside.
"I'll tell you something else that's happened before," Heinrich said. "We're running out of gas."
The dial quivered on E.
"There's always extra," Babette said.
"How can there be always extra?"
"That's the way the tank is constructed, so you don't run out."
"There can't be always extra. If you keep going, you run out."
"You don't keep going forever."
"How do you know when to stop?" he said.
"When you pass a gas station," I told him. And there it was. A deserted and rain-swept plaza with proud pumps standing beneath an array of multicolored banners. I drove in, jumped out of the car, ran around to the pumps with my head tucked under the raised collar of my coat. They were not locked, which meant the attendants had fled suddenly, leaving things intriguingly as they were, like the tools and pottery of some Pueblo civilization. Bread in the oven, table set for three, a mystery to haunt the generations. I seized the hose on the unleaded pump. The banners smacked in the wind. A few minutes later, back on the road, we saw a remarkable and startling sight. It appeared in the sky ahead of us and to the left, prompting us to lower ourselves in our seats, bend our heads for a clearer view, exclaim to each other in half-finished phrases. It was the black billowing cloud, the airborne toxic event, lighted by the clear beams of seven Army helicopters. They were tracking its wind-borne movement, keeping it in view. In every car, heads shifted, drivers blew their horns to alert others, faces appeared in side windows, expressions set in tones of outlandish wonderment. The enormous dark mass moved like some death ship in a Norse legend, escorted across the night by armored creatures with spiral wings. We weren't sure how to react. It was a terrible thing to see, so close, so low, packed with chlorides, benzenes, phenols, hydrocarbons, or whatever the precise toxic content. But it was also spectacular, part of the grandness of a sweeping event, like the vivid scene in the switching yard or the people trudging across the snowy overpass with children, food, belongings, a tragic army of the dispossessed. Our fear was accompanied by a sense of awe that bordered on the religious. It is surely possible to be awed by the thing that threatens your life, to see it as a cosmic force, so much larger than yourself, more powerful, created by elemental and willful rhythms. This was a death made in the laboratory, defined and measurable. But we thought of it at the time in a simple and primitive way, as some seasonal perversity of the earth like a flood or tornado. Something not subject to control. Our helplessness did not seem compatible with the idea of a man-made event. In the back seat, the kids fought for possession of the binoculars. The whole thing was amazing. They seemed to be spotlighting the cloud for us as if it were part of a sound and light show, a bit of mood-setting mist drifting across a high battlement where a king had been slain. But this was not history we were witnessing. It was some secret festering thing, some dreamed emotion that accompanies the dreamer out of sleep. Flares came swooning from the helicopters, creamy bursts of red and white light. Drivers sounded their horns, and children crowded all the windows, faces tilted, pink hands pressed against the glass. The road curved away from the toxic cloud, and traffic moved more freely for a while. At an intersection near the Boy Scout camp, two school buses entered the mainstream traffic, both carrying the insane of Blacksmith. We recognized the drivers, spotted familiar faces in the windows.
people we customarily saw sitting on lawn chairs behind the asylum's sparse hedges or walking in ever-narrowing circles with ever-increasing speed, like spinning masses in a gyration device.